everyone, and welcome to the XCast X-Files Podwatch, episode 26. And today we're covering The Blessing Way and Paperclip. I'm your host, Carl Sweeney, and I'm delighted to be joined by all-round X-Files guru, Chris Knowles. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Carl.
So just a reminder for people who don't know or didn't hear our last conversation together, Chris co-authored the complete X-Files reference book, and he runs his own blog at The Secret Sun. All right, so anyway, we're here today to talk about the opening two episodes of the third season. But before we get into The Blessing Way specifically, it's probably just worth saying that this was quite an exciting time for the series as a whole, really. I mean, the first two seasons, creatively, had, you know, they'd flowered. The series was picking up a bit of steam as regards to the ratings and around the world as well, I think. So this was quite a crucial juncture, I think, going forward.
Yeah, I think this is really when the X-Files taps into the zeitgeist and really starts to become a phenomenon, really starts to get noticed. I really think that this is a high point for the series as a cultural phenomenon and as a encapsulator, so to speak, of the zeitgeist. This is really where there's so much, I guess, ferment in sort of the underground of conspiracy and UFO, particularly with the rise of the internet, Usenet, things like that. And X-Files is just tapped into that mainline. You know, the internet is writing the lyrics, but the internet, the X-Files is singing the song, so to speak. It's a convergence. It's a convergence of so many different streams, cultural and socio-political streams coming together that I think you'll probably never see again, I don't think.
If someone asked you, what does the X-Files do and what could it do? The third season, you could do a lot worse than show them that. And it all started with The Blessing Way, which was written by Chris Carter and directed by R.W. Goodwin. And this is the episode in which Mulder is found near death after the events of Anasazi and is nursed back to health by Navajo Indians. Meanwhile, Scully comes to fear that her own life may be in danger. So over to you, really, Chris. What do you make of The Blessing Way? I mean, we can try and treat these episodes as individual episodes up to a point. There'll be a bit of overlap with the episodes either side, I suppose.
Well, I see it as the middle third of, like, an incredible 70s vintage conspiracy drama. I don't think that you can separate the episodes out. It's one continuous story, which is kind of ironic because a lot of people don't realize that it was originally meant to be a two-part episode. And Rob Bowman was really upset because he really wanted to direct the second installment. And, of course, it was traditional for Bob Goodwin to do the first and last episodes. There were a number of different reasons for that, but a lot of it had to do with logistics and setting up new members in the crew, things like that. There were a lot of logistical and sort of inside baseball reasons that Goodwin chose to do those episodes. But Rob Bowman was so crushed, so disappointed that Chris Carter wrote a third installment, you know, specifically for him. I know a lot of people have problems with this episode. I just think it's mind-bendingly brilliant. I know that there's a lot of issues with the dream sequence.
Yeah.
And Mulder's having this, you know, vision quest or dream where he talks to his father and to Deep Throat. You know, everybody was kind of disappointed with how that came out because it was meant to be more mystical and less Mulder sitting on a bed of salad in a dark room with people and, you know, in Doctor Who costumes. You know, that's just the nature of the beast. You can't always get what you want. You can't always get that effect that you're looking for. It's the nature of episodic television. You're under tremendous time constraints. You know, the dialogue is a little purple. I think it probably would have worked better if the sequence looked like how they wanted it to look. I mean, it's all meant to be very ephemeral and abstract, and it just, the visuals don't really carry that off. But you also have to realize, I mean, that episode was really inspired in many ways, or that sequence was inspired because Chris Carter had gone to New Mexico to partake in the Navajo peyote ritual. So, you know, he did his homework. If you just cut out the scenes where Scully has the confrontation with a well-manicured man in the cemetery, and then the Mexican standoff with Skinner, I mean, that in itself is like a brilliant X-Files episode right there. I mean, those two scenes are so iconic, are so pivotal, are so incredibly dramatic, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, it's interesting really, because that scene between Scully and the well manicured man is so sort of crisp and quite taut, and it's an interesting comparison with the Blessing Way ritual scenes. I think one of the things you said to me off air last time we spoke was imagine you know, Jerry Hardin and Peter Donat coming in and they're giving these lines of dialogue to Donat. Like, I think Deep Throat's first line is "the first thing that strikes you is the absence of time," and it goes on from there, doesn't it? But
yeah, it's not Chris Carter's best writing.
No, but like I say, there is some of his best writing through this three-parter and in this episode itself, actually. Yeah, I think any discussion of the Blessing Way should hit on that note, that the stuff with Scully is brilliant, I think.
There was a scene that was cut out, and I'm sure a lot of people have watched it on the DVD, where when Scully goes to her mother's house, which I just think is so brilliant, it's like, you know, you walked her all the way here. It's just these small beats, these little emotional beats that are so subtle, but just really stab you right in the heart. But she actually had this long dialogue with her sister, with Melissa. And as it happens, I mean, Melissa is, the implication here is that not only is Melissa psychic, because she senses that Mulder is still alive, and she, he and Scully have this connection still that she senses, you know, very powerfully. You know, Scully is very offended by this. You know, there's this interesting dynamic between the Mulder and Scully relationship being previewed in a way in this relationship that Scully had with her sister. And you start to wonder, like, what are the dynamics here? There's also the implication that Scully is psychic, because Scully wakes up from the dream where Mulder's like, you know, we've been on the bridge across the two worlds, blah, blah, blah. But also when she goes to the cemetery and introduces herself to Mulder's mother, you know, she's saying, I have this really strong feeling. It's like an intuition. So there's an interesting subtext there that not only is Melissa Scully psychic, but, you know, Dana Scully, our Scully, is as well, which I think in losing that scene, you sort of lose, I think, the thrust of this episode that, you know, these elements that people don't like with the vision quest and the dream and everything, aren't just arbitrary, aren't just there as an indulgence, but they're there because it ties into this greater strand that, you know, that Dana Scully and Fox Mulder have this psychic kind of connection. And, you know, what are the implications of that? What does that mean? What does that mean in the broader context of the series? And by losing that scene, you kind of don't grasp that as well, which I think is, you know, I know it was cut for time and they didn't feel that it was as taut as the rest of the episode was.
One of the things I've read over the years is that there was a possibility they were going to develop Melissa as a bit of a love interest for Mulder. Do you know much about that or how?
Yeah, that's actually true.
Okay.
So the plan was to bring her back and develop her as a rival to her sister and possible love interest. But what had happened is that Melinda McGraw had signed on to become a regular on another series, so she wasn't available. So they killed her off. And it's interesting too. This is a bit of trivia, but so the implication seems to be that Luis Cardinal kills Missy.
Yes. Yeah.
But Nick Lee to this day insists that he was the one who shot.
Oh right. Okay.
They would. Nick Lee and Melinda McGraw were dating at the time. So he was very concerned that she was comfortable when she's lying on the floor, you know, do you need a pillow, things like this. I mean, he was being very doting. It's kind of cute. But he insists that he was the one who shot her.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that Nick Lee wanted to claim ownership of that one. But there we go. A lot of people have had problems with the way the cliffhanger from Anasazi was resolved, because I think a lot of the discussion over the summer had been, how did Mulder get out of the boxcar? That's dealt with quite quickly, really, and they don't really dwell on it, but it's there. If you know, I mean, it's visually represented, but it's not discussed at length.
Yeah, I think the implication is being that there's some sort of hole in the train car that other alien, that those, not the aliens, but the hybrids, had crawled out of, and that's how Albert Hostein knew about them from, you know, his earlier days. Maybe it's, you know, a bit of a cheat, but at the same time, I mean, you have to not kill off your main character. I don't really have a problem with that, because in so many instances like this, it's like, I don't expect the X-Files to, you know, cross all the T's and dot all the I's, because of the nature of the the subject matter. You know, the subject matter they're drawing on is, you know, always ambiguous, is always unsettled. And I think that that carries over to the storytelling. You know, Chris Carter was always very clear that since they were dealing with the paranormal, and the paranormal is, you know, not a, a scientific discipline, that they don't want to close all those gaps. And I think some of the more, you know, some of the fans that come in from more traditional Star Trek-y kind of science fiction shows can't deal with that, you know, because everything has to be resolved. Everything has to be in continuity.
So, I mean, I love that scene we mentioned briefly with the well-manicured man and Scully. That's so good. And it was many years later when I saw the film 3 Days of the Condor with Robert Redford, and I realized that there was a very similar exchange in that film, which must have, I guess, have been the inspiration. And that leads up to the stuff with, you know, Scully being suspicious of Skinner, and that great scene in the apartment at the end.
Yeah, the Mexican standoff, yeah. This entire storyline, this three-parter, is just so filled with iconic moments. The moments that people think of when they think of the X-Files.
Yeah, I mean, I first saw this on VHS, where it was spliced together into one, almost like a movie. And obviously, that's not the way it aired. The way it aired was that Paperclip was next. So let's turn our thoughts to Paperclip.
Oh, yeah.
So Paperclip, again, written by Chris Carter, this time directed by Rob Bowman, as you talked about before. In this episode, they're Mulder and Scully reunited early on, and their investigation leads them to a former Nazi scientist living in the US, and then a disused mine where secret government records are stored. I love Paperclip. I think that if I was compiling a top 10 or a top 5, this would probably get in there. What I love is that it's so propulsive, you know, it moves like a jet plane or something, but there's still room in there, and they manage to make room in there for these reflective moments as well. And it's quite a feat, really. I think it's very skillfully done.
Yeah, I think this should be called Paperclip Show, because it's basically a demo reel of the best ever X-Files scenes. I mean, every scene is definitive. Every scene is iconic. Every scene is absolutely memorable. Even like you said, those quieter scenes, the interplay of light and shadow here gives the quiet scenes and the you know, the violent scenes and the revelatory scenes. I think they help to sort of define each other. Because if it was all just bang, 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 bang action, if it was, you know, it would be like a heavy metal concert. You just go numb after a few songs.
Yeah.
I was always sort of, I don't know, I guess the word would be ambivalent about the Syndicate, because I felt that it was scarier and, you know, it had more impact, more dramatic impact when you weren't, you couldn't really put a face on who was directing all this. You know, what you fear most, what you can't identify, what you can't see. And when you put a face on this, and they're just basically a bunch of old guys in a smoking club somewhere, it takes away from the atmosphere of the first two seasons.
Yeah, that's interesting, you know, because one of the things over this trio of episodes is that there's a big repositioning of the smoking man and of Skinner, actually. But yeah, the smoking man goes from, you know, this very vaguely defined figure. And then by the end of this three-parter, we see that he's kind of, I don't know, at times he almost comes across as a bit of a functionary, doesn't he? He's kind of...
Yeah, he's definitely the low man on the totem pole on that, station. And that's defined really brilliantly, though. Like, that scene, like, do you have the damn tape?
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You see how terrified he is. You know, he knows that he's next on the bullet list if he doesn't get, you know, come across with this. And the way he lies to them, and the way they don't trust him, you know, the way that this is, you know, the well-manicured man is just completely in contempt of him. It's just really strong character development in this arc. And I mean, it sort of takes away from the, that sort of Darth Vader sense that you had, you know, particularly in an episode like Ascension, that scene where he and Krycek are talking in the car. And it's like, you know, if you have a problem with that, we can make other arrangements. You know, it's just like, what a terrifying thing to say. You know, you sacrifice that element to bring the story arc further along. I mean, you can't stay in that those shadows forever. You have to either go somewhere or just become a cartoon character. So they had to take that risk.
Yeah. So Skinner as well. So over the course of these episodes, he goes from, you know, Mulder punches him when he's drugged up in Anasazi, and then Scully pulls a gun on him at the end of The Blessing Way. Yet by the end of Paperclip, he's integral to their sort of quest going forward. And he has that great scene with the smoking man, and Albert Hostein.
Oh, yeah.
Which, like you say, any clip reel, that has to include that scene, I think.
And Mitch Pileggi said that that's one of his favorite all-time lines in his career. You know, this is where you pucker up and kiss my ass. He just, he'd love that.
They must be bluffing at that point, surely, because I was trying to work out the chronology of the episode. I don't think Albert Hostein's had enough time to memorize the data.
Yeah, I think it was definitely a bluff, but I think it plays into how, you know, ultimately we hear later on that, you know, Cassandra Spender says, you know, you're just a coward. And I think that that scene is where we get the first inkling that, you know, for as ruthless as this man is, he's really just a coward. And you can bluff him like that because he'll believe it, because he might probably believe anything with all the things that he's seen and experienced.
Yeah.
Well, let's back it up a little, because one of my favorite all-time scenes in the entire X-Files history is that scene in the diner. And they're just sitting there discussing how they're going to, you know, not get themselves killed in a way that, you know, you discuss, like, how am I going to do my taxes this year? I mean, it's just incredible how almost nonchalant they are about how to avoid, you know, getting killed by a CIA hit squad. Just amazing exchanges. And the line I just love is when Scully says, you know, what good are those answers to anybody but you, Mulder?
Mm.
It's just another one of these stabs to the heart, because it really just cuts to the core of who Mulder is, that he's so obsessed with his personal issues, with his personal quest, you know, this personal drama in his past that drives all this, that sucks all these people into his wake. And does so much damage to the people around him. This is something I've pointed out in that later storyline with Gethsemane and Redux 2, that, you know, David Duchovny's, you know, got tired of playing this sort of credulous character and wanted to become more skeptical and things like that.
Mm.
And I think the original basis for this switch, you know, for this shift in the character, wasn't really well thought out at first. I think it was sort of seat of the pants. But in Redux 2, I mean, you really see, like, that exchange he has with Scully's brother. Another great line. It's like, you know, because I won't, you know, I won't go along with a family tragedy. And Bill Mulder just says, you're the reason for it.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, I think this is sort of foreshadowed in the scene in Paperclip, where, you know, Mulder's quest for these answers that really won't do anyone, not even him, much good in the end.
Mm. Yeah.
That he's so willing to sacrifice others around him for this sort of speaks to how, in a way, contemptuous this character is. I mean, if, you know, if you were dealing with this guy in real life, you'd be like, you know, this guy is just a walking disaster, because so many, so many people around him, you know, is his father. You know, why is his father killed? His father is killed because, you know, Mulder has to get his hands on the MJ-12 documents. You know, so he gets his father killed. He gets Scully's sister killed. You know, he's getting all these people killed because of this personal vendetta he has for reasons that most people would think were kind of arbitrary and nebulous. You see that in the scene. And that's why this scene is so great, because Skinner understands that he's been manipulated. And I think this is sort of drawing back to FM Esculada. I think that episode is more pivotal than people give it credit for, because I think that's the episode where Skinner realizes that he's just being made a fool of. And I think that's the implication. That's the sort of subtle motivation that's driving this character, that he realizes that he's being humiliated by Smoking Man. And that's what makes that exchange so great at the end of the episode, because it's like, You know, these kind of people who are kind of repressed, who internalize their aggressions. And maybe it would have been even better if that scene was more explosive. You know, that all this repressed rage that he'd been swallowing and humiliation really came out more powerfully. But I think it's such a great iconic scene as it is. But again, this is all the subtle psychological motivations that the people really have to parse out for themselves, that aren't going to be spelled out the way they're spelled out in other television shows. And I think, you know, a lot of people sort of overlook that. They don't really pick up on it, but, you know, it's all baked into the cake, as it were.
Yeah. And one other thing that's baked into the cake throughout the rest of season three, definitely, and beyond, is this kind of idea of the influence of the post-Second World War, immediate post-Second World War period into the wider X-Files mythology. So here we've got the scientist played by Walter Keitel, who figures, and then later on in episodes like Nisei, a lot of it focuses on what these scientists were doing after the war, and it reverberates through quite a few episodes. And it's another element in the mix here that works wonderfully well, I think.
Well, it gives the mythology a backbone. It gives it like historical heft. And let me just say, I mean, this is just sort of an aside, but I grew up, I'm originally from Massachusetts. And one of the neighborhoods where I grew up in is a part of a city called Quincy, called Wollaston. And right off the beach is an island called Long Island, not to be confused with New York's Long Island. Long Island, you know, right off the coast of where I lived, was actually where all the paperclip Nazis were flown into. After the war, they were all housed in a building called Fort Strong. Now, this is the really weird thing. I mean, if you look at an aerial view of Fort Strong, the building was sort of modified that it looks like a swastika from the air now, which is really bizarre. I mean, it's like a cartoon. I mean, it's like, are you serious? Is this like a G.I. Joe cartoon or something? But yeah, I mean, this, to me, Paperclip is basically a documentary. I see it in that light. I mean, it's a docudrama. You know, there's sort of the elements that maybe people will have trouble digesting, more science fictional elements, but this is all drawing on things that really happened. I mean, a lot of people don't realize that there were the Nuremberg trials about all the human experimentation at Auschwitz and Dr. Mengele and things like that, but that all was going on after the war in America. I mean, there was an entire program of human experimentation on children, human experimentation on the mentally disabled, on you know, African Americans. There was a lot of this going on, and if you read the history of it, it's really horrifying. And pregnant women being given, you know, doses of radiation. This was all very real. No matter how extravagant or science fictional it may seem in this context, it's all working on things that actually happened. And the government's, apology is policy, as the line goes, and this is really drawing on things that real life horrors. So I think that's tying this into the whole paperclip program, where the Nazi agenda comes to this country, I think is one of these zeitgeist capturing moments in the X-Files, because this stuff was in the news. I mean, they were always looking at the news to see what they could bring in to the storylines, because there's always that implication that, this is really going on. This is, that you're not watching Star Trek or Battlestar. You're watching something that is a glimpse into a secret reality. Again, that's what gave the show its punch. And a lot of people were like, well, when is the colonization going to happen? When is this all going to go down? I mean, they wanted it to be like Independence Day or something. And what they were really trying to do is make you feel as if what you're witnessing is what's really going on behind the scenes.
Yeah, it was a great way watching the series to kind of encounter this alternative American history. They did it in a very rich way at times, I thought. There's so much going on in this episode, and we haven't touched on all of it. We haven't mentioned lots and lots of files or the white buffalo.
The whole scene with the file. I mean, again, this is when people saw that scene. I mean, especially people who are tuned into conspiracy theory or the UFO underground. You know, when you see a scene like that, it's like your worst nightmare is realized. And of course, now we realize that this is actually going on. It's like, the government is actually keeping files on everybody, on everybody's genetic material, on everybody's phone calls, everything like that. We were still kind of naive in 1996. We weren't willing to go so far as to believe that this could really be true. But, for people who are really tuned into that, it's like, oh, yeah, this is my worst paranoid nightmare being depicted on screen. And that whole thing, I mean, it's like, oh my God, it's like, could this really happen? And then you start to think, yeah, this really could happen. And then now, of course, we know that it is happening.
Well, that's probably quite a cheerful note to end on there. So thanks, Chris. Tomorrow on the XCast X-Files Podwatch, it's DPO and Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. In the meantime, find us on Twitter at @X_cast or on Facebook. If you search for XCast, you'll find our group and our page. But until next time, listeners, trust no one.